Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol and on Preston FM 103.2 up in the north, and also to our listeners on Radio Verulam in St Albans. Hello also to our friends in South America in Colombia who are also listening. Sheila L. Diab is here to talk about her part in the Bristol Syria Human Campaign, and she'll be talking about the troubles that are going on in Syria and how they want to help. We'll also be hearing from Colin McNamee about how the HS2 high-speed rail link is part of a wider EU plan that we didn't vote for. Tony Gosling brings us the final part of the supernatural conversation he's been having with Bishop Sean Manchester, or rather a conversation about the supernatural, I should say, revolving around the Reverend Montague Summers. We also have some poetry from Rosemary Dunn, one of the final instalments of Treasure Island, and the What's on Guide on the Song of the Week with Jeff Sparks. I'm John Peters Coleman. It's time now for my interview with Sheila L. Diab, but to open it, I would like to read the press release that I've been handed that the Bristol Syrian Human Campaign have released very recently. It says, 1 year ago, a movement began in Syria for introduction of some reform. It began in a small way with peaceful street protests and no violence, and gradually built and spread to other areas. No call for regime change, just some reform. The president promised some reform which was not forthcoming, and then violently suppressed the street protests. This you will of course see on the news. The protests grew and spread into different areas of the country, and violence intensified. That much is history now, and 7,000 are now dead, many arrested, and allegations of torture and violence intensifying daily. The UN tried to pass a Security Council motion. The international community expressed concern. Sanctions are imposed, and political analysts drew comparisons with Iraq and Libya. And what now? Well, it continues on, but I mean, that is a good point to actually pause and ask that question of Sheila L. Diab. Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
What now, indeed? What does the... well, for a start, let's start with who are exactly the Bristol Syrian Human Campaign? How long have you been going?
We've been going about a month. And we started because members of the Syrian community, a small group of them, there's only a small group in Bristol, who have lived here for many years and work here with their families, decided that help was really needed. So they approached different people. And we got together as a group, some Syrians, non-Syrians, some English, all different faiths, to try and raise awareness here for the refugees which have had to leave Syria because of the violence and flee with their families into the neighbouring countries of Turkey, Lebanon and Jordan.
Yeah.
And this has happened over the last 12 months. And fleeing and surviving with your families. The countries have taken them in some cases, into their family homes. In some cases, families are renting in whatever cheap is possible,
okay.
Rooms, and some of them are in tents in this kind of weather.
So how, I mean, what now, I suppose, begs the question, what can you do on the ground in Syria?
Well, basically, there's some charities out in Syria at the moment. We can't get anything in. The people in Syria at the moment that are suffering are having to suffer.
Okay. And let's rewind a little bit. I mean, tell us a little bit about the general situation in Syria, because you said this has been going on for 12 months. That may surprise some people.
Well, of course it will have surprised people, because I think possibly the government there, maybe, had learned from Egypt and from other countries that have had reform calls in the last few years. And they immediately slapped a press embargo on any calls, any films. So therefore, the general public outside Syria didn't hear about it.
I mean, without getting too bogged down in the intricacies of the politics, I mean, is the Bristol Syria Human Campaign sort of against interfering in sort of military or peace UN interference in Syria's affairs, or would you say you are for that?
Neither. We just want the killing to stop.
Hmm.
What we're focusing on is what we can focus on, which is the refugees which have fled outside Syria.
Okay, and how are you going to do that?
basically, there's some charities on the ground which have been working now since the beginning. Islamic Relief is one of them, yeah. Only one of them. But this is one that we are working with. What we are trying to do is raise awareness, collect charity money, which they will then transfer across and use to help the actual refugees on the ground with which they're working.
Okay, so it's sort of intermediaries trying to raise, like point out what's actually going on to try and suck in, you know, as much money as possible so that
absolutely.
It can go to where
because
it's
the general public, as all humans, are quite happy to help people if they know they need help.
Hmm. You went on Radio Bristol, I understand. What was that like?
Oh, that was fine. But actually, it wasn't on this subject. So.
Okay, it was on a different subject. Okay.
Yes, it was. It was on actually something to do with Baroness Worsley's speech in the Vatican. And they asked for different people, different faiths, to comment on it. Okay. So that had nothing to do with Syria as such.
People would, I guess, assume that this has something to do with you know, the sort of Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Springs that's been dubbed by the press. Would you say this is all part of the same thing? Is this sort of like a continuation of like what's been happening in Egypt and these other places?
I think it might appear so to outsiders. I don't think anyone will ever know what started the call for reform. It's possible that there has been the request for reform a long time. You've got to also bear in mind that when this president came to power, he actually said, when he inherited his presidency from his father when he died, he actually did promise reform.
Oh, and they always do, they often do.
Yes, but he started.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, it didn't carry through. So nobody is going to know unless you're able to talk to the people that originally started the progresses and the protests as to what triggered them to start at that moment in time. So I don't think I can judge that. I could say it appears that success in other countries may have given them the hope that they could. But nobody can really tell.
Tell me, you've got an event coming up. Tell me about the event that you've got coming up to try and raise funds.
Thank you. I will, certainly. With Islamic Relief and the Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, we're actually having a charity dinner on Sunday. And it's a little bit of advertising here. It's at Bristol Grammar School, which is not a million miles away from the centre. And it's the tickets are £10. We're trying to raise, of course, charity. It is the beginning event for this campaign. It's just this first one of hopefully many.
OK. Whereabouts is Bristol Grammar School exactly? If people are...
It's just off Queen's Road.
OK, yep.
And it's quite central. They've been kind enough to give us the Great Hall. We're expecting 400, we hope.
Okay. And what time is it on Sunday?
It is 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
And the reason it's 6 o'clock is because we have a second room with an entertainer for people, families with children, that aren't able to attend unless they bring their children.
Okay. Can people, I mean, if people are listening to this on Sunday and thinking, well, hang on, that's only a few hours away, can people sort of turn up if they haven't sort of pre-bought a ticket?
It's quite simple to actually, it would be better if they could buy a ticket. But if they contact Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, the number, I think you'll probably be able to read out, they can actually reserve and purchase a ticket right up until the event.
Oh, brilliant. OK. Yes, for more information or to book tickets, please contact Bristol 0117 952 1802. There's also a mobile phone number here, so I'll ring that as well, I guess, in case the other one is busy. 0787 2407 338. And tickets can be collected also from the Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, which is number 404 Stapleton Road. So this has been going on for quite some time, and the media has not been quick to pick up on this. I mean, why has it taken so long?
Why has it taken so long for this society to form? Or why has it taken so long to come to the actual press's attention?
Well, why have we not been hearing about it?
Basically, the Syrian community that is over here are actually under great pressure because if they do speak out, which these brave people have decided to, then the backlash in their country of any siblings or family there is severe, severe indeed. I've got an example of somebody actually not speaking out but thought was speaking out, and his parents were put in, beaten up and put in intensive care on basis of that information.
How on earth do they, you know, does the regime in Syria know what on earth is going on?
Because people tell them.
So, I mean, the freedom to speak between people, it also includes the freedom to oppress, unfortunately. Okay, interesting. Well, unfortunately, we can't go any further because we've run out of time. But tickets for the meal are £10, and a number to book tickets on is Bristol 952 1802. Or it starts at 6. You can turn up today, 19th of February, or before, if you listen to this after, in which case you've sadly missed it, at the Bristol Grammar School, University Road, BS1 1SR. But if it's they are listening to this, I mean, they can always get in touch, I guess, with the campaign.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you're still interested in raising funds, obviously.
Of course.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When Michaela was presenting last week, she interviewed Colin McNamee, and she did another second interview with him because he was so terribly interesting. And this particular interview that she did is about the HS2 high-speed rail link, which Colin McNamee says is part of a wider EU plan that we didn't vote for.
It's my great pleasure to welcome back Colin McNamee, a regular contributor to Dialect. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Michaela.
And today you're going to be talking to me about the high-speed rail link. People may have heard about it on the news. What's your kind of take on this? What's your angle? And if people don't know about what HS2 is, can you give us a bit more detail?
What's my angle? That's a very good question. I think it might be better directed at the government. What's their angle? Because one thing that they don't mention is the connection back to the good old EU. I know it sounds a bit like a pantomime that it's behind you again, but it genuinely is actively involved in the high-speed link. With a country of our size and the population that we have, why are we spending this amount of money when we're supposed to be and are in an economic crisis to take 20 minutes off the journey from London to Birmingham, and then it links on to Manchester and it splits to go up further north? There are other methods of running that train and improving the existing surface, which independent groups have put forward. The government has to develop that link, and that's why it's come up with, to satisfy the amount of protest, another 6 tunnels at increased cost. But they've not mentioned back to the European Union. The European Union has a roadmap for a single European transport area. It's called 10-T, the Trans-European Network-Transport. Now, I'm not making this up. It can be checked. There is a white paper about it. And the EU requirement is that there are 2 levels of transportation. One is the core network, and there is a comprehensive network. The core network, if you look on, I've got the page number somewhere, page 43 of a paper called Connecting Europe Facility Paper, and you'll see that the core network, High Speed 2, runs Belfast, Dublin, Holyhead, Birmingham, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Birmingham. And then you start to pick up London, Lille, Brussels, Dublin, Cork, Southampton. Now, if you take the start and the end of there, you've got Havre, Paris, London, Dover, Calais, Paris.
But why? Why this grand plan? What's the reason for it?
Well, part of the raison d'etre for the European Union is a federal Europe. Now, this just isn't about the breakup of the UK, it's about the breakup of every single country within the EU into regions. Now, under the Labour government, the regions of the UK started, there are going to be 12 of them, 4 of them are already in existence thanks to the Labour government, and there is an EU map, not just covering the UK, but the whole of the EU. And the regions, the 4 regions of the 12 that have been established are Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales and London. That leaves 8 to go. The 8 regions were passed to John Prescott to manage. Unfortunately, and fortunately for the rest of us, but unfortunately for him, he failed, so it got exposed. Now, That the regional network and the sub-regions are very important because the regions become trans-Manche regions. In other words, the regions of the UK merge into bigger regions with countries. So the eastern side of the UK moves into Scandinavia, and parts of the south move into parts of France and parts of Belgium to form a bigger region.
But these are just transport links. Surely freedom of movement and goods, all of that is good for our economy. That's why we've joined the EU in the first place, isn't it? I don't understand why just by tabling a few kind of areas, ideally what we're talking about here is just some extra transport. You know, whatever the grand plan is, surely it's better for the economy.
I agree. What we joined was a single market, not a federal state. So an important pillar of the European Union policy is actually entitled Policy for the Territorial, Economic, Environmental and Social Cohesion of the EU. Not my words, their words. Now, the Transport for Union that I've referred to as the Trans-European Network, there are some words towards the end of that paper which says, I'm picking up your valid point, ensuring the smooth functioning of the internal market and strengthening economic and social cohesion. It is part of the move towards a federal states of Europe. This is not what we signed up for. The High Speed 2 is part of that. The reason why it is being driven through is bugger all to do with Cameron and the government. He's having to do what he's told to do, because, as you rightly say, we've signed treaties. But the electorate hasn't agreed to it. And a lot of our sovereignty is being whittled away, and we aren't aware of it. The Liberal Democrats, for example, would have had us in the euro in 2005 and coming up to 2009. That's why they're called the Federalist Party. They would have had us fully into the euro. There's a lot of indication now that so would Blair.
So you're suggesting there's a kind of a creeping integration with every one of these projects. Slowly and slowly, we become more of a federal Europe without even our, obviously the democratic deficit is a big problem, but even with Cameron not wanting that, he's got no choice.
I'm not normally known for subtlety, Michaela. I'm not suggesting it. I am hopefully stating it very clearly that there is the political elite of the UK and the other countries have a political agenda that is not approved by the electorate. And Cameron, for all his huff and his puff, by the way, what happened to that veto? Never mind, it didn't happen because what was he vetoing? There was no treaty at that point to veto. But he grabbed the headlines, he pacified his backbenchers. It's huff and puff, it's smoke and mirrors, and we're being dragged into the illusion.
I think the thing that the struggle most people would have is how can we just leave Europe? How can we possibly do that? If this is what's happening, people disagree with it, there's a democratic deficit and we're not making the decisions anymore. Just leaving, is that something that's even possible?
Yes. The Single European Act can be repealed. A lot of people rightly worry about the effect on the economy. It was interesting that last year, not only David Cameron, but Nick Clegg, as Deputy Prime Minister, in TV interview and radio interview, talked about our exports to the EU being 40%. Of our total exports. That actually is pretty accurate. It is about 40%. But up until last year, all major political parties, with the exception of UKIP, were talking about 50% of our exports go to the EU. It's not true. 40% is about the right figure. Now, that was last year when Cameron and Clegg were asserting certain economic policies. If you look at any of their interviews over the last 6 months, magic. Those export reliant has now gone to 50%. Nothing has changed. What they're doing in the 50% is approximately 8 to 9% of our exports go to Rotterdam and Antwerp for containerisation for onward shipment to the rest of the world. So they conveniently include that 8 to 9% when it suits them. So the 40% moves to 50%. Not true.
But 40% is still an awful lot when we're in a point of economic turmoil in our country. If we suddenly just found it harder on that 40% to trade with Europe. Surely this isn't the time to be discussing this, is it?
Oh, yeah, indeed, very much so. Because the other part of our exports to the rest of the world, we are governed by the treaties that we've signed within the EU as to the terms that we export to the rest of the world. For example, Mr. Cameron allegedly had a very successful trip to India last year and deals were signed. Obviously, it's a political thing, the deals have been done beforehand. But he had to get EU agreement beforehand. It's the single market is a level, supposedly, a level playing field within the EU. So we cannot trade openly or to the best advantage with the Commonwealth. We have to get agreement within the EU. What we import from the Commonwealth, emerging markets are very much India and China. We have to get agreement with the EU to export to them. It's wrong. We are a global trading nation. We shouldn't be narrowed within trading to Europe. And nobody's talking about a war with Europe, but if we were, and hopefully nobody's stupid enough to do that, an economic war I'm talking about, we buy more from the EU than they buy from us. Fact one. Fact two, more people in continental Europe, did you like that? Continental Europe, the rest of the EU, are employed in exports to us than people employed in this country in our 40% to the EU. And in any event, I say in any event, I used to be in exports as part of my sales and marketing. And I've worked for Scandinavian countries as well and companies. And I've also worked for a Chinese company. The level market, I voted in favour of in 1976. There's a lot to be said for it, but not for the political shenanigans and the cost, not only in money, but sovereignty that's come to this cost this country. So there is a way out. An actual fact, a Southwest UKIP MEP, Trevor Colburn, has got an 18-minute film out, which was launched during February. So it's really hot off the press, and it's talking about the consequences and the advantages of leaving the EU. Now, Trevor Coleman can be contacted through the net or through UKIP at Newton Abbott, and you can view this actually online. So, and it's not just UKIP. You'll find some Labour MPs, strangely enough, Frank Field, some of the Labour MP, Labour used to be against the EU. It was only Blair that changed all that. The Lib Dems have always been in favour. That's why they're called the Federalist Party, which will be coming more and more apparent. But this film coming out from UKIP, there is a life outside the EU. That's what Norway have found.
So there is a feasible alternative. Thank you very much, Colin.
Thank you very much to Colin McNamee and also to Michaela Twint for interviewing him. Over the last century, one of the world's leading authorities on the supernatural, as well as world expert on cannibalism and vampires, not from his own personal experience, we trust, was the son of a Clifton banker and one-time curate in Bath and Bitten, the Reverend Montague Summers. He died just after World War II, but his writings about those who abandon God and open the forbidden doors to the other side on vampires and demonology live on. A bishop today who follows this independent Catholic tradition dedicated his best-selling book, The Highgate Vampire, to Montague Summers. Our Tony Gosling has been asking the Right Reverend Bishop Sean Magister about the similarities between his own journey of faith and that of Bristol's Edwardian eccentric. This week, the final part of the interview, how Bishop Sean Magister believes people are sucked into selling their souls to the dark side.
You talk about the 3 degrees of witchcraft, but I mean, that's something we normally associate with Freemasonry, isn't it?
Yes, because witchcraft in its present day manifestation is born out of Freemasonry. I mean, the originator of the modern witchcraft craze, which goes no further back than the turn of the 20th century, goes back to Gerald Gardner, who, again, immensely influenced by Aleister Crowley, whom he knew. And Gardner, apart from being a pervert, was very much influenced by Hinduism. He spent time out in the East and engaged in all sorts, like Crowley did, sexual experiments and sexual perversions, and was obsessed with nakedness. And he, more or less, is the founding father of modern-day witchcraft. And he was a high-ranking Freemason. And Crowley himself was a Freemason. And so they adapted the first 3 degrees that really most Freemasons only ever receive. They don't ever usually go any further than that. It's the base of the pyramid and therefore the largest area of members. And he adapted those three degrees of craft masonry to the craft, witchcraft. And look, there are good and bad people in every organization and none. I mean, there are some pretty sinister people in the church. There are decent people, no doubt, who are Freemasons and who think they are witches. You can't judge them by their mistakes or taking a turning which has involved them in a certain area, which of itself is perhaps a little bit left-hand path, hence the Latin term sinister. So there's good and bad in all walks, and I'm sure there are some really lovely people who describe themselves as witches. But that's not what witchcraft means, any more than the word vampire means people who drain your energy, unwittingly or not, when you enter a room. It's simply use of the term. The term witchcraft is known. I mean, Summers is close to knowing what witchcraft is about. And if you read what he has to say about it, then you're getting much closer to what it's about. But in the modern sense, what I've discovered is that many very dangerous and diabolical groups use witchcraft as a training period to see if somebody's able to be taken further. So if they're not, they never really discover the secrets, and they find a way to discourage them.
So how would they make a decision like that, that somebody is able to...
It's a slow process. I explain it in From Satan to Christ. What happens is they engage them in what at first seem innocuous ceremonies and activities of nudity and a little bit of bloodletting, maybe, mixing blood with wine and so forth, which the average sort of acolyte isn't really put off by. But slowly but surely, it's a very gradual process of introducing something a little bit further. Then they start to introduce animal sacrifice. Now, at that point, many will balk. Many will be turned off. And then it'll be explained to them at some point, maybe you're not quite the right person for this coven, this group, this order. And they will leave. But they use such techniques of manipulation that what they try and do is make the person feel guilty if they don't participate. And they get them to participate to sufficient a degree where they have something by which they can be blackmailed. Therefore, they have involved themselves in maybe illegal activities, maybe animal sacrifice, maybe rituals in a graveyard which were profane and totally illicit, maybe disturbing a church, similarly at the altar, to get hold of the host, to use it in a consecrated wafer in a way which would be blasphemous. Now, they would just find a way to involve them where they could hold that over them, saying, well, you've come this far, you might as well, you know, if it was found that you were engaged in this sort of thing, and we have the evidence that you were, you know, they will then participate further. I mean, unsurprisingly, in the modern witchcraft covens, they're very, shall we say, liberal on matters of not just perversion, but sexual activity. And you discover in some covens a high degree of prostitution. And that is, in some cases, a form of earnings or income for that coven. It can be quite organised.
That was the Right Reverend Sean Magister talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about his 1988 book, From Satan to Christ, A Story of Salvation, and one of Bristol and Britain's greatest Edwardian experts on the supernatural. The Right Reverend Montague Summers was writing and publishing from his home in Clifton during the First World War, becoming one of the greatest editors and collectors of Gothic ghost stories, as well as an acknowledged world expert on the supernatural. Next up is the penultimate instalment of Treasure Island, as ever read by the trusty seafarer Malcolm Grieve. Thank you.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6, Captain Silver. Chapter 33, The Fall of a Chieftain. There never was such an overturn in this world. Each of these six men was as though he had been struck. But with Silver the blow passed almost instantly. Every thought of his soul had been set full stretch like a racer on that money. Well, he was brought up in a single second dead. And he kept his head, found his temper, and changed his plan before the others had had time to realise the disappointment. "Jim," he whispered, "take that and stand by for trouble." And he passed me a double-barreled pistol. At the same time, he began quietly moving northward, and in a few steps had put the hollow between us two and the other five. Then he looked at me and nodded, as much as to say, "Here is a narrow corner," as indeed I thought it was. His looks were now quite friendly, and I was so revolted at these constant changes that I could not forbear whispering, "So you've changed sides again." There was no time left for him to answer in. The buccaneers, with oaths and cries, began to leap, one after another, into the pit and to dig with their fingers, throwing the boards aside as they did so. Morgan found a piece of gold. He held it up with a perfect spout of oaths. It was a 2-guinea piece, and it went from hand to hand among them for a quarter of a minute. 2 guineas, roared Mary, shaking it at Silver. "That's your £700,000, is it? You're the man for bargains, ain't you? You're him that never bungled nothing, you wooden-headed lubber." "Dig away, boys," said Silver with the coolest insolence. "You'll find some pignuts, and I shouldn't wonder." "Pignuts?" repeated Mary in a scream. "Mates, do you hear that? I tell you now, that man there knew it all along. Look in the face of him, and you'll see it wrote there." "Ah, oh, Mary," remarked Silver. "Stand in for a cap'n again? You're a pushing lad, to be sure." But this time everyone was entirely in Mary's favour. They began to scramble out of the excavation, darting furious glances behind them. One thing I observed, which looked the well for us, they all got out upon the opposite side from Silver. Well, there we stood, 2 on one side, 5 on the other, the pit between us, and nobody screwed up high enough to offer the first blow. Silver never moved. He watched them, very upright from his crutch, and looked as cool as ever I saw him. He was brave, and no mistake. At last Mary seemed to think a speech might help matters. "Mates," says he, "there's 2 of them alone there. There's the old cripple that brought us all here and blundered us down to this. The other's that cub that I mean to have the heart of. Now, mates." He was raising his arm and his voice, and plainly meant to lead a charge. But just then, crack, 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 3 musket shots flashed out of the thicket. Mary tumbled head foremost into the excavation. The man with the bandage spun round like a teetotum and fell all his length upon his side, where he lay dead, but still twitching. And the other 3 turned and ran for it with all their might. Before you could wink, Long John had fired 2 barrels of a pistol into the struggling Mary. And as the man rolled up his eyes at him in the last agony, "George," said he, "I reckon I settled you." At the same moment, the doctor, Gray, and Ben Gunn joined us with smoking muskets from among the nutmeg trees.
"Forward," cried the doctor. "Double quick, my lads, we must head them off from the boats."
And we set off at a great pace, sometimes plunging through the bushes to our chests. I tell you, but Silver was anxious to keep up with us. The work that man went through, leaping on his crutch till the muscles of his chest were fit to burst, was work no sound man ever equalled. And so thinks the doctor. As it was, he was already 30 yards behind us, and on the verge of strangling when we reached the brow of the slope.
"Doctor," he hailed, "see there, no hurry."
Sure enough, there was no hurry. In a more open part of the plateau, we could see the 3 survivors still running in the same direction as they had started, right for Mizzenmast Hill. We were already between them and the boats.
And so we four sat down to breathe, while Long John, mopping his face, came slowly up with us. "Thank ye kindly, Doctor," says he. "You came in about the nick, I guess, for me and Hawkins. And so it's you, Ben Gunn," he added. "Well, you're a nice one, to be sure."
"I'm Ben Gunn, I am,"
replied the maroon, wriggling like an eel in his embarrassment. "And," he added after a long pause,
"how do, Mr. Silver?"
"Pretty well, I thank ye. Says you?"
"Ben, Ben," murmured Silver, "to think as you've done me."
The doctor sent Grey back for one of the pickaxes deserted in their flight by the mutineers, and then, as we proceeded leisurely downhill to where the boats were lying, related in a few words what had taken place. It was a story that profoundly interested Silver, and Ben Gunn, the half-idiot maroon, was the hero from beginning to end. Ben, in his long, lonely wanderings about the island, had found the skeleton. It was he that had rifled it. He had found the treasure. He had dug it up. It was the haft of his pickaxe that lay broken in the excavation. He had carried it on his back in many weary journeys from the foot of the tall pine to a cave he had on the two-pointed hill at the northeast angle of the island. And there it had lain stored in safety 2 months before the arrival of the Hispaniola. When the doctor had wormed this secret from him on the afternoon of the attack, and when, next morning, he saw the anchorage deserted, he had gone to Silver, given him the chart, which was now useless, given him the stores, for Ben Gunn's cave was well supplied with goat's meat salted by himself, given anything and everything to get a chance of moving in safety from the stockade to the two-pointed hill, there to be clear of malaria and keep a guard upon the money. "As for you, Jim," he said, "it went against my heart, but I did what I thought best for those who had stood by their duty. And if you were not one of these, whose fault was it?" That morning, finding that I was to be involved in the horrid disappointment that he had prepared for the mutineers, he had run all the way to the cave, and leaving Squire to guard the captain, had taken Grey and the maroon and started, making the diagonal across the island to be at hand beside the pine. Soon, however, he saw that our party had the start of him, and Ben Gunn, being fleet of foot, had been dispatched in front to do his best alone. Then it had occurred to him to work upon the superstitions of his former shipmates, and he was so far successful that Grey and the doctor had come up and were already ambushed before the arrival of the treasure hunters. "Ah," said Silver, "it were fortunate for me that I had Hawkins here. You would have let old John be cut to bits and never given it a thought, Doctor." "Not a thought," replied Dr. Lizzie cheerily.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Gree for reading Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, and thank you to Robert Louis Stevenson for writing the book. Next week will be our final instalment, so make sure not to miss it. We'll also be revealing what our new serial will be next week. You're going to have to wait until next week to find out what it is. Tim couldn't make it into the studio, unfortunately. He broke one of his roller skates, but he has sent a track called Sky Martyr. Thank you. Thank you very much, Tim Burrows, and hopefully he will be able to come in next week. Ah, it's a pleasure to introduce Rosemary Dunn to the studio.
Hello there.
Hello. Your poetry all previously has usually been of a soccer nature or is often football related. Is this the same?
At times it is, yes, but not always. No, because it's Valentine's Day today.
Ah, different theme today. Okay.
Although we won't be going out Valentine's Day. I've got a Valentine's poem-ish.
Okay.
Okay. And it's called I Want You. Like Hillary Clinton wants the White House, that's how much that I want you. Like chocolate fountains beat hands down a cheesy après-skeezy fondue. Like shaggy dreams of Daphne tickling his tummy like Scooby-Doo. Like an ashram hippie needs a Maharishi in the Nepalese valley of Kathmandu. Like Rolf Harris can't address a morning without wobble board and didgeridoo. Like the sonnet with all the words written on it by Will Shakespeare is the only sonnet that will do. Like Marvin Gaye needs to get it on with a song, baby. That's how much that I want you.
Kathmandu is a particularly suitable place for poetry, isn't it?
It is now.
Yeah. Do you have another one for us? We've probably got time for another one,
well,
I think.
I do, actually. Yes. And this one is about Summerside seaside towns, because I remember when I was a kid, actually, people still do that. They go and park in their cars along the front.
Yeah. Yes.
Eating their sandwiches and thermos flasks. So they don't eat their thermos flasks. They open their thermos flasks and have tea and look out to sea. I always find that quite funny. So this is called A Summerside Seaside Town. It's night in a Somerset seaside town. All is quiet. There's no one around save for the dealer plying his trade, supplying school kids who hope to get laid under the pier where the shingle is smaller, more easily moulded for late night spillage. Frantic young love ignores the stink of sewage. It's Sunday in a Summerside seaside town. We're all lined up along the prom. Coupes and saloons bask in the sun. Their elderly occupants stay inside. They face the sea with salt dry eyes. Along the summer seaside promenade, children run or skateboard past between sips of lukewarm coffee from thermos flask lids. Cars enjoy a fresh sea breeze. It's summer in a Somerset seaside town. The open-air lido, concrete steps, a black-headed seagull hangs in mid-air, spies the child with ice cream cone away from the group, motherless, alone. The bird swoops and steals its prize right from under the scared kid's eyes. It's closing time in a Somerset seaside town. Gangs of lads and giggling girls spill from the pub. Shouts threaten the peace of double-glazed marrieds in rooms above. Bottles smash to splinter the street. Another 10 minutes and then we can sleep. Cans of Stella shoved in hedges. Needles discarded in the vicar's garden. Brakes squeal from handbrake turns. And in a cul-de-sac, a Ford Fiesta burns in a Somerset seaside town.
Blimey, a bit of a dystopian end to that one.
I know. Bitter and sweet. Well, sweet, yes. And sweet and bitter then, with the Valentine's.
Quite a documentary edge to that, I think.
Seaside time. Yes. Thank you.
Rosemary Dunn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Time for a What's On Guide, and here is Jeff Sparks. Hello.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 24th of February, First Degree Burns will be performing with support from Redfoot at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Into Saturday, 25th of February, the tribute to Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin, Purple Zeppelin, will be performing at Fiddler's in Railway Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance and £9 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present The King Blues. This group formed in 2004, and to date they have released 4 albums. This is from the album Save the World, Get the Girl, and it's the track I Got Love.
Well, I'm gonna dance like nobody's watching. I'm gonna sing like no one's listening. I'm gonna kiss you like we're all alone, cause this world is ours. We're the have not but the have all. Twice the speed of lightning I travel. Through the universe I will run to write your name in the stars. Cause I'm truthful, last forever. Music can bring the world together. I got life, man, I will use it till they lay me down to rest. So let's party in the supermarket, move to the rhythm of my heartbeat. I take my towel right off my neck, wear it tied around my head. Cause I got love, I got so much love, love in my heart, and this feeling I can't let it go. Yeah, I got love, I got so much love, love in my heart, and this feeling I can't let it go. Well, mountains crumble as I pass. To last, I feel a spirit rise inside me. Something's happening in the air. With my feet right on the ground and my head up in the cloud. We are one people, we are equal. You are wonderful and rare. And I got love, I got so much love, love in my heart. And this feeling I can't let it go. Yeah, I got love, I got so much love, love in my heart.
That was the King Blues with I Got Love from the album Save the World, Get the Girl. For more information, you can check out www.kingblues.net. Keeping with Saturday 25th of February, Boot Led Zeppelin will be performing at the Horn in Victoria Street, St Albans. Doors open at 9 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Finally, on Sunday 26th of February, Catherine Sykes will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
More Zeppelin tributes than you can shake a stick at. Thank you very much, Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to Sheila Eldia for coming in for being interviewed, and also to Colin McNamee. Our features were by Tony Gosling, and Tim treated us to a song, Sky Martyr, who always sent it in, and we hope it comes back in next week. We also have one of the last episodes of Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve, the very last one next week, and Jeff Sparks gave us the Watson Guide. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce, and we also had Rosemary Dunn reading a poem. Thank you very much to Johnny Royden for doing the editing this week, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. I've been John Peters Coleman. If you'd like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can always find us on dialectradio.co.uk. We also have a WordPress website, and we also have a page on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. We are volunteers. This is all voluntary. So if you're interested, if you're living in Bristol, contact Volunteering Bristol. You can look them up on the internet or ring them on 989 7733 if you want to get involved.